Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Helen Crane. And coming up, inflation might be back on target, but is the damage already done? Another hold for rates, and the Bank of England doesn't look that keen on a cut. So what will it take for a move down? Nationwide have started paying out more than £100 fair a share payments, but plenty of loyal customers are pretty unhappy at the moment. And would you let your parents pay for a family holiday as an adult? Don't forget, you stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
I'm Lisa Kaplan from Charles Stanley Direct. I spent 15 years helping people understand their finances with clear, jargon-free language. People often ask me whether they have enough to retire, what to do about inheritance tax, or how best to invest. Often, it's a simple question that one of my expert team can answer straight away, and we would love to help you too. Contact us for a free 15-minute chat at coaching@charles-stanley.co.uk. Investment involves risk.
But first, it was a double whammy week for us personal finance journalists. First, we had inflation figures, followed the next day by the latest interest rate decision. Good news is that after a pretty hair-raising few years, inflation is back to target. 2% in May, down from 2.3% the month before. So obviously the Bank of England celebrated the news with a rate cut the next day, easing the pressure on millions of mortgage holders. No, that's not actually what happened. It seems no one is exactly rejoicing. I mean, maybe the Prime Minister. I wouldn't say rejoicing, maybe just a teeny tiny smile. But especially not our Lee Boyce. But firstly, welcome to you both. The inflation figure. Helen, welcome. What's the latest with inflation? What's behind the drop?
Yeah, so quite big news, as you say. Inflation has hit 2% in May, down from 2.3% the month before. And that's significant because 2% is the level that the Bank of England says it wants to essentially keep inflation at. That's, you know, the last couple of years, inflation obviously running rampant. They've said that 2% was their target, where they wanted to get to before they considered cutting the base rate. And we're now there. So that's good news. However, as you said, that was not followed by a rate cut. There's various sort of reasons for that, which I think we'll probably come to a bit later. But part of it is that when we talk about inflation, there's several different figures within that that contribute to the overall inflation rate. So CPI, as I said, is at 2%, but core inflation, which includes things like food and energy bills, is still higher at 3.5%. And services inflation is at 5.7%. So still quite a lot higher. So I think the bank is kind of looking at that and thinking, you know, we are heading in the right direction, but actually those other two figures aren't where they necessarily want them to be. And they're going to sort of hold steady for a while, see where those things go before making the decision to hopefully cut rates.
Well, we will delve into that, as you said, in more detail about why the Bank of England decided to hold rates and what that means next. But Simon, article by our very own Lee Boyce. We'll be dealing with the aftermath of 20% inflation in 3 years for a while yet. What's he upset about here?
Well, I think this is something that has tempered people's joy at inflation falling back to the target figure of 2%, which obviously does mean that things are still getting more expensive, just 2% more expensive, rather than the 11.1% more expensive that they were at the peak. But it won't have escaped many people's notice that life is not getting cheaper. Life is just getting more expensive at a slower speed. And that's what Lee's talking about here, because we were discussing this in the office the other day and talking about, you know, what have been the effects of this. And if you look at the inflation index, you look at the numbers, you'll see that since inflation really started to pick up, you know, since it was last at its target, we've had 20% consumer prices inflation. And there are many people who suggest that that actually undercooks the level of inflation that most people are feeling. I think there won't be many people listening to this podcast who won't think that their lives have definitely got more than 20% more expensive over the last 3 years. And it's things like grocery bills, energy prices, everything that you need to buy. I mean, the cost of, you know, this is disposable spending, right? The cost of going out to dinner now is so much more expensive than it was 3 years ago. You know, a main course that used to be, you know, maybe it was like £12-14, like you go to somewhere for dinner, not particularly fancy, you go to the pub, and almost all the main courses are over £20. You know, it all adds up to so much. One of the things that's noticeably quite expensive this year, I think for many people, is flights. And also, if those who think they're saving some money by driving on holiday and heading across the channel to France, Eurotunnel, which I think is called Le Shuttle now, and ferry prices are really, really high. And you look at all of these things together and you just think they're not going to go back down, are they? That it's not going to get any cheaper. And this is the point that Lee's making, is we're stuck. We've got the price point now. Now, things might get a bit cheaper. For example, you look at something that's very volatile, like petrol. Petrol has, at times over the last 3 years, been phenomenally expensive, quite a bit cheaper than it is now. It contributed to the inflation figures. Actually, it gave some upward pressure in the inflation figures for the last month. But petrol prices have actually since fallen because the oil price has tumbled. So that's quite volatile. But you look at your grocery bills, for example, and food prices actually came down slightly in this inflation reading. You can't see them coming back down to where they were. Energy bills. Our energy bills are going to go down slightly on the 1st of July. Can't see them going back down to where they were anytime soon. And they're forecast to rise again, potentially, you know, in summer. So, I mean, there's some research that's been done by the Energy and Climate Intelligence Unit. And it pointed out that a basket of some food staples has risen by 40% in the past 3 years. So this basket of goods, which include, it's not like fancy stuff, potatoes, rice, broccoli, coffee, has increased from £23.73 to £33.96 in that time. The price of a bottle of olive oil up 136% wow, since June 2021. Bag of sugar up 72%. Potatoes, I mean, they're not fancy. No. So there's some people maybe, I don't think this is money.
Well, podcast. You can make them fancy.
They can make them fancy. You might require that olive oil, though. Mm. I was going to say, I don't think This Is Money podcast listeners think olive oil is fancy. I think they're the kind of discerning people who know that olive oil is a marker of a good diet and a long, healthy life. And they won't be listening to this going, you fancy Dan's with your olive oil. They'll be saying, ouch. But
yeah,
nobody could suggest potatoes are fancy.
No.
They are up in price by 49%, a 19% increase since just December 2023. However, as somebody whose brother-in-law is a vegetable farmer, I know they've not had the easiest year of weather this year. Mm. So anyway, this report says, although year-to-date inflation is down, prices have stayed near record levels, and for many foods have not come down since they started to rise rapidly in the second half of 2021. So the big thing is, you know, what's going to happen next? And I think that people are looking at this and going, okay, our wages have gone up. We've actually, for the first time in a long time, seen real wage increases. But actually, inflation has eaten up almost all of those wage increases. And the other thing that has eaten up a lot of those wage increases and made this much, much worse is, unfortunately, tax and frozen tax thresholds, which have dragged more people's income into tax, more people's income into higher rate tax, and so on, and exacerbates the pain of this inflation.
If you want to listen to Simon's manifesto for tax reform, listen to... well, last week, and then I think there was another one before that. But as I said last week, just re-listen to all our episodes. Just do it. It's great. Helen, I like Lee's comment here. The inflation dragon is drowsy, but not completely out for the count. I think about what Simon's just said whenever I go into a coffee shop and think, yeah, what? £4 for a cup of coffee? It's not like, though, they're going to go, oh, things are looking better now. Let's reduce it to a more reasonable price. No, those prices are there, aren't they?
Absolutely. I was talking to a friend about this the other day, someone who's not a financial journalist like us, a normal person. And his question was, all right, so if inflation is going, when will my cheese get cheaper? And I had to break it to him, your cheese probably won't get cheaper, just your wages will gradually, hopefully, increase to meet the cost of the cheese.
The question we're all asking, yeah, when is our
ultimately,
cheese?
Ultimately, what you need is more cheddar to pay for your cheese.
Yeah,
exactly.
Touché.
That's the thing. And actually, a lot of this is, in a way, in the hands of people like the supermarkets. And, you know, businesses have had a tough few years as well, so they're not going to bring down their prices just because inflation's a bit, you know, even if their costs do go down, they're certainly not going to bring down their prices to the same level. As Lee's saying in his column, you know, things are still, like, inflation has absolutely jumped and things are just kind of now staying at that still very high level, still going up a little bit. So it still does feel really painful. I mean, I've certainly been in the supermarket looking at the olive oils and agonizing over whether I'm going to buy an £8.50 olive oil or a £10 olive oil. It is still so difficult when you're in the supermarket doing a weekly shop. And that, you know, you're right, that's going to continue for quite a while, I think. And the things that aren't included in the inflation figures, you know, costs are going up in all areas of people's lives. Things like people's mortgage payments are going up. You have to think of this in the whole scheme of people's monthly budgets. And, you know, it does feel like most things are still kind of on the rise. As Simon said, like petrol and things like that have kind of gone up and down. Energy bills are sort of hopefully coming down in general, but might go up again later this year. So it's I think people are kind of being hit at all sides at the minute, it feels like.
Okay, that's inflation. So the Bank of England, as Helen pointed out a bit earlier, let's go into more detail as to why the Bank of England decided to hold rates again. I mean, a couple of weeks ahead of a general election, you can imagine it's sort of, it's kind of understandable. Indication of when rates might fall, though. The minutes of the meeting, Simon, what was in there?
I think what was in there was the tone of a monetary policy committee that is in no rush to be slashing the base rate. Bear in mind, at the start of this year, there was a flurry of excitement about 3 or 4 base rate cuts in 2024. We're now down to maybe 1 or 2 base rate cuts. There's talk that an August rate cut might be on, but then also it might be September. And then markets are suggesting perhaps November, which doesn't really leave much room for 2. I think that we might see 1 this year, but I don't think we'll see more than 1, to be honest. I don't see any particular reason why the Bank of England would want to be dramatically cutting interest rates. There are 2 people on the MPC who want to cut interest rates. There are 7 who want to hold. So you've got to shift that to at least 5 to 4, right? Or 4 all, but one of them is... my maths is very bad there. If it's 9 people, you have to shift it to 5 to 4. Apologies, everyone. Is that going to happen? Maybe if we start to see, you know, a marked indication of a slowdown. But the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee go diving quite deep into these figures. One of the things they're going to be looking at is inflation, services inflation, is 5.7%. I mean, that's still pretty high. And there is this concern that inflation might pick up. And if you look at, you know, I think maybe one of the key things that was said in the Bank of England minutes, it was this. I will read it out to you. Monetary policy will need to remain restrictive for sufficiently long to return inflation to the 2% target sustainably in the medium term in line with MPC's remit. The committee has judged since last autumn that monetary policy needs to be restrictive for an extended period of time until the risk of inflation becoming embedded above the 2% target dissipates. In normal person's language, we don't think that we are out of the woods yet, and if we start cutting rates now or cut them too aggressively, we think it will contribute to inflation going back up. Undertone, we had so much grief about inflation spiking in the first place and us being behind the curve that we really don't want to be accused of that again. And so whilst there are some people out there clamoring for a gazillion rate cuts in the shortest possible space of time, we're not listening to them.
It does make it seem, I've said this before, but just extraordinary when people at the turn of the year were going, oh yes, 6 rate cuts or something this year. Really?
3.75% by the end of the year, some people were calling.
What were they expecting the environment to be like? You know, like, it sounds it's so crazy. And I think you said it was crazy at the time.
Yeah. And look, I think the other thing you have to bear in mind is, like, maybe there is potentially the opportunity that we could cut rates more. And we do need to cut rates more because of all of the things that we were just talking about. I don't think the full impact of all of the rate rises and all of the inflation on the economy and on people's pockets has filtered through yet, right? So people are genuinely feeling the squeeze, and the Bank of England raised rates so aggressively and so quickly that it didn't really allow for those effects to come through. And maybe we went too far. But on the other hand, I genuinely think central banks are looking at the situation and going, the silver lining to this cloud is that basically it took us so long to get rates off the floor that we don't have any plans to aggressively cut them. And yeah, they'll probably go down, and they'll probably go down a bit. But anybody thinking that they're going back down to, you know, 2% even, let alone 0.5%, is in la la land unless we get some major, major economic crisis or deflationary bout, which, to be honest, is not the kind of thing that you want to wish for, just to get interest rates back to abnormal levels.
Helen, I want to see how this is playing out in the areas of our personal finance. Let's start with mortgages. I mean, so no change in the base rate means mortgages are just flat and no change there?
They have been largely flat. So there's been some small ups and downs. Obviously, the recent peak for mortgage rates was back last summer around August 2023, when rates were almost 7% on average. So 6.86 on a 2-year fix and 6.35 on a 5-year fix. They have come down by about 1 percentage point from that. So average 2-year at the minute, 5.97, and average 5-year, 5.53. However, there has been a bit of an uptick since the start of this year. They were a bit lower around February, about 5.5 for a 2-year and 5.2 for a 5-year. So they've kind of edged up a little bit in recent months. And I think that's off the back of these forecasts about base rate cuts coming later rather than earlier. You know, banks will price in all these things quite well in advance. So I think they're now sort of realizing that all these predictions of, you know, 5-6 base rate cuts this year haven't happened, and they're now kind of bringing rates back up kind of in line with these less sort of confident predictions about the future. I think Simon's right in saying that anyone who thinks the base rate is going to go substantially lower in the next few years, you know, we're not going to get to sort of 1-2%, and that's going to be reflected in mortgage rates. So I think they're probably, when the base rate does get cut, mortgage rates will go down a little. But still, speaking to people in the mortgage industry, they're still saying, you know, 4%, 4.5% is possibly where the averages will sort of land for the foreseeable future. So we're certainly not going back to those 1%, 2% mortgage rates anytime soon, unfortunately.
So anyone fixers coming to deal, anyone looking to get a mortgage or whatever, the advice is, you know, actually there's not such a, it's not a panic to wait. That doesn't really make sense. But actually, just get on with whatever you're going to do, because it's not going to change that much, is what the experts are saying.
I think so. So a while back, there was a sense that, you know, you might want to wait if you were, you know, sort of thinking about moving but hadn't sort of fired the starting gun yet. You know, maybe wait for a few months, then rates might go down. I don't think people are saying that so much anymore. It's a case of if you want to move and you can afford the house that you want to move to and the mortgage rates are comfortable for you, then just do it. I don't think we're going to see much change. And there's an interesting conversation now as well around whether to go for a 2-year fix or a 5-year fix. There was a time when almost everyone was going for a 2-year fix because they were thinking, actually, in 2 years' time, I could remortgage again and my mortgage could be quite a lot cheaper. Actually, more people are now kind of going back to the 5-year fix and thinking, you still have to make a call on what you think is going to happen. But I think taking a 5-year fix today is not necessarily the worst idea. Again, if the payments are affordable, and you know, there is a good chance that mortgage rates might not move that much in the next 5 years, which sounds crazy to people who've, you know, lived through the last few years and mortgage rates have kind of absolutely, you know, gone from basically nothing to kind of huge amounts. But it seems like we're in for a period of definitely kind of flatter rates and you know, more kind of calm in the market, I suppose.
And something to add to that is that when I took my first mortgage in 2006, it was a 5-year fix at 4.99%. And that was considered to be an exceptionally good deal. That was considered to be basically historically cheap money to be able to fix for 5 years at below 5%. It was a cracking deal, and we took it. And for most of that period, we were winning. Obviously, you know, interest rates were slashed shortly after that. You had the financial crisis, but mortgage rates didn't come down. And, you know, eventually mortgage rates came down, and maybe for the last year of it or so, we could have been paying less, last year and a half, but we'd saved money in the other periods of time. We hadn't ended up staring down the barrel of having to remortgage in 2008, which we would have done if we'd taken a 2-year fix. And boy, was I glad we didn't have to remortgage in 2008. And we just didn't have to worry about it. You know, you just like, we could afford that amount at the start of the mortgage. We knew we could afford that amount as long as, you know, we continued to be employed and all that kind of stuff. And we just filed that away, back of the mind, didn't even need to think about it. And in for most people, you know, unless something goes wrong, your earnings will go up over that 5-year period. So the rate that you lock in at and the payments that you lock in at will hopefully become proportionately cheaper for you compared to your wages. So there is a lot to be said for, you know, just going, okay, this is what it's going to cost me at this moment in time, and I'm just going to have to accept that, rather than playing the whole game of, oh, well, it could go down, oh, woulda, shoulda, coulda, oh, I missed out, or whatever. Just, you know, do it. I'm not saying definitely take a 5-year fix, by the way, but, you know, seriously consider it, but just do it, file it away. Never look at that. Never look at that decision again. Don't look at mortgage rates for the next 4 years.
Yeah.
If you do it, you know, don't ever be looking at, oh, it could have been this cheap or whatever, because it could have gone the other way. You can't predict what's going to happen. And, you know, in my personal experience, you know, we could have saved money for a little bit at the end of that, but slap bang in the middle of it, we might have been in trouble.
All right. Helen, savings. What does it all mean for savings?
Yeah, so savings rates have gone down in the last year or so. However, they are still way above inflation. So the best 1-year fixed account, 5.21%, that's down from just over 6% last autumn. Still decent rates. Easy access, the best account is 5.02%, down from 5.2% earlier in the year. We are past the peak for savings rates, but if you compare that to 2% inflation, you know, there's still some decent accounts out there. And I think actually now if people are thinking there's going to be base rate cuts, it's maybe worth, if you have money that you don't need on hand necessarily all the time, then maybe it is a good time to kind of look at fixing your savings for a year or longer, lock in at kind of today's better rates. Because if the base rate does start coming down, then they're probably going to start falling more.
And on your website, if anyone wants the best savings rates, you've got them for everybody. And okay, Sign up to the email as well.
Yes, right. So go to thisismoney.co.uk/save, where you will find our independent Best Buy savings tables, which are updated on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. As rates change, we update them. And if you want a savings account and you want the best savings account, don't just accept whatever your bank or building society is offering you. Choose the best savings account. Go there and pick one. I mean, a couple of my favorite savings deals at the moment are cash ISAs, right? So rates on easy access cash ISAs are actually better than rates on standard easy access accounts, which is unusual, but is a really good thing. Because if you put your money in a cash ISA, you don't have to worry about tax on your interest. And everybody has a £1,000 personal savings allowance, unless they are a higher rate taxpayer, of which there are many more nowadays, and then they only get £500. And if they're a 45p taxpayer, they get nada, nothing at all. And if you're in the position of having your child benefit taken off you or your personal allowance taken off you, you don't really get a tax-free savings allowance because it counts towards that. So put your money in a cash ISA. Get a flexible cash ISA, because then you can take money out and you can pay it back in within the same year. Right. And this means that you can just use your easy access cash ISA pot as your savings that you dip in and out of. Makes it like so much better. It means you don't have to pay savings tax. You can get rates. CHIP pays 5.1%. Zopa pays 5.08%. Plum pays 5.17%. But that isn't flexible. And then you've got some other banks that pay like kind of around the 5% rate. 1-year fixes still look pretty good value if you want to fix your money for 1 year. And then actually Sylvia Morris, who's our savings expert, she really likes 2-year fixes at the moment. I think because on the basis that rates are probably going to fall over that 2-year period. But yeah, there are some good savings deals out there. This is money.co.uk/save. And while you're there, stick your email in the box at the top to sign up to our savings alerts, because we will email you as soon as a really good savings deal lands. And they don't last long. And there are 21,000 people getting these emails, and they find out about the best savings deals before anyone else. So make yourself, one of them.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Lisa Kaplan of Charles Stanley Direct for our weekly Investing Explained feature. Lisa, we've got a question here. How much should I keep in cash as an emergency fund?
Hi Simon, it's a good question. Sort of the rule of thumb that I use when I'm talking to people is 3 to 6 months of expenditure. So if something happened, and you were unable to work, you didn't have income, you want to have breathing space. So you're not painted into a corner and you're not desperate. So you want to have a nice little pot that you can be secure about while things sort themselves out. It'll vary. I mean, it's 3 to 6 months is very much a rule of thumb. Some people have steady income. If they have a pension, for instance, they don't have to worry so much. They need to worry about the roof falling in or something like that. Just having enough for unplanned expenditure. But some employed people have sort of lumpy income, the self-employed, for example, and they'd probably need to have a bigger safety net than someone who's on a regular salary.
And so there's the question of, have I got enough in my emergency fund? But there's also the question of, how do you know if your emergency pot is too big?
Yeah, I do see that people who are holding on to a lot of cash, and honestly, they're holding on to it because I think they're a little wary of investing and a bit scared. So I think give it some thought. Think, well, what could go wrong? Think about the negative things and keep a pot to cover that, but be reasonable. And after that, you really do want to put your money to work. I mean, the money will be spent one day. So keep some of it for your emergency fund, and the rest, think how you would like that money spent and put your money to work in the appropriate way to achieve that.
Lisa, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
Welcome back. Nationwide announced last month that it'd be paying out another hotly anticipated fairer share payment to its customers, so 385 million to 3.85 million members. But not everyone, as we all know, is eligible, and it's got some people a little bit annoyed, actually. Read a question from loyal members of Nationwide Building Society since 1974. You can't get much more loyal than that. They don't qualify, and they're not happy. Firstly, Helen, remind us about Fairer Share, if you would.
Fairer Share started last year, and this is a one-off £100 payment that Nationwide is paying to some of its members. There are various things you have to do to qualify, which we will, I'm sure, go on to discuss. But it's basically off the back of Nationwide making massive profits last year. They made big profits again this year, and their idea is to share that out with this sort of cash payment to some of their members.
But Nationwide, so the problem is, as we've said before, Nationwide have, eek, is it about 17 million customers? And so the idea of 3.85 million customers or members getting a payment, what happens to the rest of them?
Well, they get absolutely zip, Georgie.
Nothing. Chuff.
So I suppose Nationwide's idea is to give this money to what they consider the most loyal members. However, as our reading question
Quite.
shows, this person is clearly
Tell us
extremely
about that reader. Go on, give
loyal.
me some information.
So he has, as you said, he's banked with Nationwide since 1974. This is him and his wife. They currently have about £100,000 at held with Nationwide, so quite a significant sum of money. They said they had their mortgage with Nationwide. They've paid it off now, but they are true loyal Nationwide members, and yet they aren't going to get this payment. They've also said that their daughter, who also has a current account with Nationwide and a savings account, is going to get the payment. So they wrote in asking, kind of rightly, why don't I get this? And our savings reporter, Helen Curran, has looked into it for them. there's various kind of hoops that you need to jump through to get this money. On a basic level, you need to have two products with Nationwide. One needs to be a current account. The other one can be a savings account or an ISA or a mortgage. And you had to have had them, obviously, in the last calendar year. So our reader does have a current account with Nationwide, and he has an ISA with Nationwide. So he's jumped through that first hoop. He's good. However, there are some subsequent rules about the activity that you have to have done on your savings account and current account. So this person essentially holds their £100,000 lump sum in a Nationwide current account. And then every year, once a tax year, they take out £20,000, their ISA limit, and put that into a Nationwide ISA. So they're only essentially doing one transaction per year on these accounts. Right. That's where they've fallen down. So the rules say that in, so they base it on the 3 months, January, February, March 2024 are the months they look at. You need to have received at least £500 into your current account. Transfers in from other Nationwide accounts don't count. And you need to make two payments out of your current account. If you don't do that, you can also qualify by making 10 payments out of your current account in those 3 months. They've basically fallen down because they have these accounts, but they don't use them very regularly. They just use this account to fund their ISA, and they've therefore fallen foul of this transaction requirement. It's a difficult one, isn't it? I can understand why these people are annoyed. You know, they hold a lot of money with Nationwide. They're clearly very loyal customers, but I suppose it's difficult. You know, Nationwide, they could have paid it to everyone, but the amount would be much less. And the difficulty with something like this is trying to sort of make it fair, isn't it? So Helen spoke to James Blower, who's a savings expert, and he said, if you go to every single member, then people who miss the cutoff by a day would be upset. And those who've been customers for decades are upset that those who've been customers for 5 minutes get the same payment. So there is sort of no easy way to do this. And you sort of have to feel a little bit bad for Nationwide. Like, none of the other banks are doing this, and they're getting absolutely loads of flack for the way that they're defining who gets the payments. I mean, they're kind of damned if they do and they're damned if they don't. I think it's just a really, there's always going to be some people who are annoyed about this, I think, unfortunately.
Yes, I get that argument, and James Blower is an expert on this subject. Simon, what do you think they should do? What have they said, actually? What have Nationwide said to this particular case?
Nationwide said, all our members share in our success, and the Nationwide Fairer Share payment is just one way that we reward members who have chosen us for their everyday banking relationship. Last year, we returned a record $2.2 billion in total value to members. The Fairer Share payment has set eligibility criteria requiring both a qualifying current account and qualifying savings account or mortgage. I can see why these people would feel aggrieved. Mm-hmm. Nationwide would argue that what they do is, as a building society, they put their profits back into giving better deals to their members. And so that the savers in this instance have already benefited from better savings rates than they would potentially get with a rival bank, because Nationwide is paying back in that way, and that the Fairer Share payment is on top of that. I can see how you would be very annoyed if you had fallen foul of like a second order criteria. Mm-hmm. But then also, I think maybe if you've got Nationwide accounts, or you've got money with Nationwide, you need to look at this and think, right, they're going to do this every year. Maybe they are. They've done it 2 years now. I mean, we started talking about, are they going to do it, you know, before they did it, trying to work out whether it would happen again. And the signs pointed to yes. So maybe check out those qualifying criteria and just make sure that you meet them. You know, get yourself prepped now and just make sure that you're doing it and you meet them. But then, to be honest, I nearly fell foul of this. I'm a Nationwide customer. I have been a Nationwide customer for many years. I have an active bank account that we use on a daily basis with Nationwide. I've also had money in Nationwide savings for years. However, I transferred my ISA away from Nationwide because the good rate that was on it fell after, you know, whatever, a year, and it ended up being a rubbish rate. And actually, I could get a much better deal elsewhere. And I transferred my ISA away just after the qualifying date. So I was very, very close to the first time in many years not having savings in Nationwide, which would have meant that I wouldn't have got my Fairer Share payment, which would have been really quite annoying. But luckily, I fell on the other side of it. So you can see how, as Helen says, you know, there's always going to be...
You win some, you lose some.
There's always going to be some kind of, you know, cut-off in some people who fall foul of it. But it's very unfortunate if you've got £100,000 in Nationwide and you've fallen foul of it.
And you've been with them since 1974.
I would feel massively aggrieved if I were these people.
All right, then. And finally, I remember when my dad said a real moment in our relationship was when I first bought him lunch. I was 35. I mean, lunch is one thing. Never did he buy me a holiday. I would like to point out now, I mean, I even bought his season ticket, Derby season ticket. I do now treat my dad. But it's not enough that millions of parents are helping their kids get on the property ladder. The Bank of Mum and Dad is also forking out quite substantially on taking their adult children away on holiday. Helen, have you been away on holiday with your parents in your adult years?
I have not been on holiday with my parents since I was a teenager. However, this data really didn't surprise me because I have quite a lot of friends in their 30s who do still go on holiday with their parents. So this is data from Kent Reliance, and they say that more than 2 in 5 parents pay for their adult children to go on holiday with them every year. And every year part did actually surprise me a bit. Parents are increasingly paying for their adult children, and in some cases their families, you know, grandchildren, to have a holiday with them every year. I think this is part of the cost of living going up, you know, as you said, people having to rely on help from their parents to get on the property ladder, and it's kind of just an extension of that, really. You know, young families, time's quite tough for them, budgets quite stretched, and you know, generous parents and grandparents are saying, you know, if I want to have a family holiday with all my children and grandchildren, then maybe I'm going to have to pay for it, which is, you know, extremely generous. But the people who spoke to in this article said, you know, it's actually worth it for me because otherwise I wouldn't get to spend this time with my children, and it's the thing I look forward to most in the year. You know, these holidays can be thousands of pounds if you're taking a large family on holiday. It really is kind of incredibly generous. But I think it's just another one of these trends of, you know, older people who do have that spare cash having to help out, well, not having to, what wanting to in many cases, help out their children and give them a nice holiday.
Simon, you go on away on big family holidays, don't you?
I'm going away on a big family holiday. I've got a big family. Yeah. I'm going away on a big family holiday. Not with every single member, but with most of the members.
That's nice. Do your parents pay for that?
In October. We're paying for our, well, okay, look, bear in mind, there's me, my wife, our two daughters, my sister, her two daughters, ooh, and my other sister and her two daughters who are young, then my mum, and my mum's also taking my brother's daughter. My brother's not coming with his wife because they're due to be having a new baby just before that. So there's quite a lot of people there. There's quite a lot of kids, isn't there?
Yeah.
Right. And, I mean, you know, we're paying our share, but my mum has, you know, generously offered to pay for the villa, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But like, there's offering to pay for it, and then there's kind of expecting to go. So if you've got your kids coming to you as adults expecting to be taken on holiday, right? But then, you know, on the other hand, my mum comes regularly away with us, and she pays for her bit and we pay for our bit, or we'll cover some of it and stuff like that. It's, you know, it washes itself out. But I have over the years benefited massively from going on holiday with my parents. We always used to go on holiday when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And then when I became an adult, and you know, first of all, I was away myself anyway. Then I was at university and didn't have any money. Then after that, I went away again. And then I still didn't have any money. And then I was a low earning, you know, local journalist. I was definitely still benefiting from the odd holidays. You know, I fully expect to be paying for my children to go on holiday with me after the age of 18, because I'm just paying it back. That's what happened to me, and that's what I'm going to do for them. I would expect them to be grateful and to appreciate it and want to spend time with us.
We'll enjoy it.
And I would value spending time with them. You know, that's one of the reasons why sometimes my mum comes on holiday with us. That's why we're going on holiday all together, because you don't get to spend that kind of time all together as a family. But I think it is that kind of like, there's a gratitude and an appreciation and doing it for the right reasons. And then you can definitely see the other side of the coin, where some 29-year-olds throw in a strop because their parents aren't taking them on holiday and want to go by themselves. The one thing I would say is that financially speaking, this is actually quite a wise move. And we talked about this a few weeks ago when we talked about an Ask an Expert question that we had to do with inheritance tax. If you are going to have an inheritance tax liability, right, and there are many people in this country who are going to have an inheritance tax liability because of their house, right? It's just the house that's going to cause it. Money that you spend, you can consider it that everything you buy is 40% off. If you're going to be over that inheritance tax threshold, then your estate, the money over that, is going to be taxed at 40%. So I remember speaking to a financial advisor many years ago who said, I always tell my clients who are worried about inheritance tax to start flying business class. Yeah. And they say, we can't fly business class. We're not the kind of people who fly business class. We've saved and worked hard our lives. We're not flying business class. That's a waste of money. And he says, what if I told you it was 40% off? And they're like, well, yeah, I might consider that then. It's like, well, that's what you need to think about. And that's maybe what people should think about who are in that position and, you know, taking their adult kids on holiday is, do you want to pay to take your adult kids on holiday? No, I'm not paying for them to go on holiday. What if it was 40% off? Maybe I might do. There is also a middle ground, isn't there? You don't actually have to pay for the entire thing.
No, no.
You obviously could just get them to contribute something, you know, and adult children out there benefiting from your parents' generosity, like pay for the odd meal, you know, offer to pay for dinner while you're on holiday. Take your parents out to holiday. Take your grandparents out to holiday. Not take your parents out to holiday. Take your parents out to dinner sometime while you're not on the holiday. Randomly buy them some stuff. Treat them. Make them feel good. Make them feel appreciated.
I don't know if this is just because I don't have kids, but I wouldn't dream of having my parents now pay for anything. They will pay for nothing when they go. I'll take them out. You know, I'll take my mum on holiday. They'll pay for nothing.
But then there are many people in this country, and this is a generational issue, one that has been commented on many times, whose parents are considerably richer than they are. There's lots of people out there who've got pensioner parents, who've got final salary pensions. That
I'm sure my parents are richer than me, but it's just that I don't have kids, so I feel a bit, you know, I'm paying it back to my parents because I can't pay it back to my kids.
Yeah, I tell you once, I got caught out once when I was about 25. We went away. Me and my dad went away. We drove. My brother was working in the Alps. My sister was working in the Alps at the same time. And we went to see them both. And my brother was working in France and my sister was working in Switzerland in Verbier. So we went, saw my brother, stayed there a few nights. Then we went and saw my sister. Obviously, my dad had been paying for quite a bit of stuff while we were away. I'd been trying to pay for things, but he'd been basically picking up the tab for a lot of dinners and everything. I was like, right, I've got to take him out for dinner. We went and saw my little sister. I was like, right, we're going out for dinner before she started work. I was like, I'm going to pay for dinner tonight. Dad was like, thanks. We'd only gone to a pizza restaurant, like, and it was just quickly before my sister started work. I was like, this is a good evening to have offered to pay for dinner. I'm going to get away with this one, like, relatively cheaply. Totally hadn't factored in the fact that Verbier is the most ridiculously expensive place on the planet. I walked out of there having paid for a quick meal of pizza and a couple of beers and a bottle of wine between three, £150 lighter.
Ooh, well, you know.
And it didn't even look that generous because all I did was pay for pizza.
Sure you had a good time nonetheless, Simon. I'm sure you had a good time. Right, that is it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you have any comments or questions or anything you'd like the team to look into, then Simon.
You can email us at a different email. I'm going to give you a different email. Email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. You know, many years into the podcast, we now have our own specific email, podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. Tweet us @thisismoney. Come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past. And tell us your tales of either being taken on holiday by your parents or how your lousy parents won't take you on holiday. Or share your experiences of your freeloading children and grandchildren and why they are unappreciative little wretches.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
I'm Lisa Kaplan from Charles Stanley Direct. I spent 15 years helping people understand their finances with clear, jargon-free language. People often ask me whether they have enough to retire, what to do about inheritance tax, or how best to invest. Often, it's a simple question that one of my expert team can answer straight away. And we would love to help you too. Contact us for a free 15-minute chat at coaching@charles-stanley.co.uk. Investment involves risk.